Julius Baer attracts a large Jewish clientele.
He said he made many mistakes because he was under pressure. They put him under pressure, in psychological pressure, kind of mobbing, etc. Elmer never wanted to have money. And quite to the contrary, others, I mean, Kieber in Vaduz or Falciani in Geneva, other cases, they said, I want some millions and I go to the Secret Service. Elmer sent his data to the tax man. I mean, the tax authorities and the papers, the press.
He's guilty in most points.
Banking secrecy.
Yes. He has to pay 240 times 30 French.
The central issue of the trial is to decide whether the Swiss law on banking secrecy includes data from the Cayman Islands. Two theories abound.
Heidi, what happened yesterday when we left you?
Basically, we drove home and Rudy was having a little nap in the car because he was exhausted after the whole day. And I felt like I was hungry and wanted to have something to eat. And we had a friend with us and we were going into our car subterranean garage. And two cars were following us inside. I didn't think of anything. Again, two black BMW Skodas and black cars. And once we had parked and Rudy opened the door, they jumped out of the car and said, Mr. Irma, you are arrested. And we were like stone-faced. We couldn't believe what just had happened.
This arrest had nothing to do with the trial that had taken place the day before. This new judicial investigation was triggered by Elmer's recent handover of data to Julian Assange.
I was anxious about Helena because she was alone in the house. Private files, banking files, personal banking files, personal health files, even unpaid bills were taken. They knew that everybody is exhausted from the day. Would not allow me to see her in the face. And she was in tears, having policemen around again. She was in tears. They would take him away, which they did. And it's a trauma. And she is not the first trauma she had lived through. And she knew exactly what would come.
Could you confirm that Mr. Elmer is here in this prison?
No.
You can't confirm.
No comment.
And no visit?
No comment.
And no visit?
No visit, no comment.
Dear David, how is the world treating you and your family? There's not much going on here besides the usual questioning. My health is deteriorating slowly but surely. However, I don't wish to complain. I'll survive as usual. By the way, I won success at the Federal Supreme Court. The prosecutor's office of the state of Zurich now has to investigate the whole issue of harassment by the private detectives. This was a real setback for the Zurich Department of Justice, whose continued decisions to not open an investigation were considered arbitrary by the Supreme Judicial Authority of Switzerland. While Rudolf Elmer was in prison, Bank Julius Baer had some legal issues. The bank agreed to pay a 50 million euro fine to Germany to avoid prosecution for assistance in tax fraud. In the US, the bank was indicted on a conspiracy charge. A New York court accused it of having helped wealthy US taxpayers to hide over $600 million from the tax authorities in Switzerland. Meanwhile, without any evidence against him, Rudolf Elmer remains in prison, in custody for 187 days under strict conditions.
My family, my wife wasn't allowed to visit me for 6 months. My daughter, I could see only every fortnight for an hour. There was a window between us, so the family had a difficult time. Now, on my side, I was in a cell and 23 hours locked in, but I'm still the same person. I still haven't changed. I still think I have done the right thing. And my recommendation today is to blow the whistle anonymously. That's the only way, because there is no protection in law for whistleblowers. On the contrary.
Rudolf Elmer's time in prison only strengthened his convictions. He now spends his time in specialized seminars on tax havens in order to feed his fight.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for this, our annual meeting of the task force, focusing this year on the shadow financial system.
How did you convince the people in the Isle of Man to say their privacy is not being violated by automatic information exchange?
Legitimate privacy versus the legitimate need to exchange information. You know, there are some countries in the world where tax offences carry the death penalty, and I say that against...
I have enormous sympathy for Rudy Elmer. I think that Swiss law may have been drawn to its furthest point to justify keeping him in jail for 6 months without the evidence being made available as to whether or not he actually broke Swiss law.
This was the power of the state being used to support fundamentally an illicit, well, let's be blunt about it, an illegal activity, tax evading. But tax evasion is the basis of the Swiss economy. You know, that's what the Swiss banks work on. Since 1934, when Switzerland put their banking secrecy in place to deliberately help people from other countries evade tax, all the other stories about why they created their banking secrecy are rubbish. They did it to help people evade tax, and they still are.
November the 17th, 2011, Rudolf Elmer went to the High Court in Zurich for his appeal trial.
You have no final sentence. The general attorney has to look for more evidence. You have to go further in the details with the general attorney how to provide them the data they need without violating the bank secrecy of any customer.
Is it possible?
I think so.
How?
You will see.
It's not only a slap in the face of the prosecution office, it's also a slap in the face of the judge who found me guilty in January. And it's a slap in the face as well on the other prosecution office which was responsible for putting me in prison 19th January after the trial. The legal or the judicial system itself concludes they have done a poor job. So I hadn't to prove that they have done a poor job. They concluded themselves that it was a poor job. So that's a wonderful feeling.
Can you explain the deal you made with the bank? I mean, regarding your complaint for stalking.
It's a very difficult topic. I have to think about it first. I have to wait here. I can't drive when I say that. Yeah, Josh said yesterday it was a deal, and yes, it was one. I agree, and
with the bank.
It was with the bank, yeah. If you consider this case has was going on for 6 years, from a legal point of view, the judge would have requested maybe some sentences, but we as victims, because of this harassment, would have received maybe 5,000, maybe 10,000 Swiss francs for compensation, and that's it. And then on top of it, I haven't had a job for several years now because of this issue. I lived for my fortune, and I'm running out of money. So, and then I do have a child, which is only 12 years, and I want to give her a proper education, because my daughter lost a lot in respect of her childhood, and that's the sort of compensation she receives. And therefore, I don't think I will lose my credibility as a whistleblower.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Allah, 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 All
before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the laws on istihada, and you also, of course, according to Ayatollah Sistani's system of rules and laws, Islamic laws, and you talked about different types of istihada, and we already covered in the previous episodes about a few of the rules and laws, ritually speaking, about the little and the medium istihada. What about the excessive istihada? What is necessary? What is obligatory for a lady to perform in the state of excessive istihada?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, excessive istihada, as we can understand from the title, from the name, involves excessive bleeding, and when a woman is bleeding excessively but irregularly, she is supposed to be in the state of excessive istihada, and of course she has to follow the rules related to excessive istihada. A woman who is in the state of istihada is supposed to perform 3 ghusl, okay?
Yes.
3 ghusl during 24 hours in order to perform her daily 5 times prayers. Now, one ghusl has to be performed early in the morning before the Fajr prayer,
mm-hmm.
and she has to, as soon as she performs the ghusl, she has to take quick action to perform the Fajr prayer, because there should not be any gap between the ghusl and the prayer, because she might discharge blood.
Yes.
If there is a gap, if there happens to be a gap, okay. And then, of course, for the noon and afternoon prayer, or dhuhr and asr prayer, she has to perform another ghusl. And of course, she should not allow any gap between the ghusl and the prayers, because if there is a gap, then of course she has to perform ghusl again, because there is blood coming out. And this is the second ghusl she is supposed to perform. And then there's another ghusl which comes before the Maghrib and Isha prayer, or the evening and late night prayer. These 3 ghusl should be performed before the prayers, and there should not be any gap or any distance
mm-hmm.
between the ghusl and the prayers which are offered. And of course a woman should prevent the flow of the blood, whatever. Maybe she might want to use a tampon or maybe a menstrual cup or whatever. She's allowed to use all of these stuff, but she must not let the blood spread out onto the pad, because while she is praying, she should not have any blood, anything, or any clothing on wearing,
which is bloody,
which is stained with blood.
Uh-huh, I see. What about some people who would like to offer the prayers, in fact, separately? Because
right.
it is somehow normal for some people, and they like it this
very much. Of course,
it's
more recommended. It's yes. more recommended.
Yes, more recommended too. Yes, of course. So are these ladies, in fact, obliged to perform ghusl more than three times, like in the state of excessive istihada?
You're right. Well, as you rightly mentioned, of course, it is necessary for a woman who offers her Zuhr and Asr prayers or Maghrib and Isha prayers separately.
Yes.
It is necessary for her to perform ghusl, five ghusl, because as we said, there shouldn't be any gap between the two prayers, and if there is a gap, then of course she has to perform one ghusl for every single prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question comes up: is she supposed to perform wudu also after the ghusl? According to Ayatollah Sistani, wudu is not required. Wudu is not required. Unlike other religious authorities who say and who are of the view that ghusl istihada is not sufficient for wudu, and that a woman is supposed to perform wudu as well,
mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is not necessary for a woman who is in the state of excessive istihaza to perform wudu after ghusl. Okay,
yes.
So ghusl is sufficient, and therefore, if a woman wants to offer the five times prayer separately, as it is recommended, of course,
yes.
then she has to perform one ghusl for each prayer.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break, and we'll be back.
Sure.
Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islam Gloss on RIB English Radio. We are still on the topic of istihada, the irregular blood discharge. And I'm just going to ask you, Sheikh Javid, about this question. You know, is it permissible for a woman to insert anything other than a cotton to determine the type of istihada, given the fact that you... divided into three types?
Oh, well, that's permissible. Of course, it's permissible for a woman to use anything made of wool or cotton or any kind of fabric.
Yes.
To determine the type of istihada.
I see.
Of course, she cannot insert something like a piece of, let's say, something made of plastic, okay,
mm-hmm.
because blood will not penetrate into it.
Yes.
So anything like a piece of cloth made of wool or cotton can be inserted by omen to determine the type of istihadha, of course.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question would be whether it is permissible for a lady to insert a menstrual cup, for example, or a tampon to prevent the flow of the blood. Is it permissible for a lady to do so?
Yeah, according to Ayatollah Sistani, of course, it is permissible for a woman to use anything, including taking pills to prevent the flow of blood, okay?
Yes.
Some ladies, for example, travel to Mecca and they want to prevent the flow of blood. Maybe it is the blood of Hayz, or monthly period, or it is the blood of Nifas, or any other kind of blood. Of course, she is allowed to use tampons, and she's allowed to use a menstrual cup to prevent the flow of blood to other parts of her body. It is permissible. But there is one thing Ayatollah Sistani says, that if a girl is, let's say, virgin and she has the hymen, of course she should make sure that the menstrual cup or the tampons do not somehow damage, let's say, her hymen.
Yes.
Okay? Otherwise, she shouldn't go for the tampon or the menstrual cup.
I see. A very quick question again, since we are at the end of this episode. Is it also permissible to for the ladies to, in the state of istihadha, in fact, to have sexual intercourse during the irregular bleeding?
It is, of course, permissible for a woman to have physical intimacy and sexual intercourse. Of course, it's even if the woman is discharging blood, of course, since it's not menstrual blood, it is kind of irregular blood. Of course, generally speaking, it is permissible for a woman who is in the state of irregular blood, who is in the state of istihadha, to have sexual intercourse with her husband. And the Islamic Sharia has allowed sexual intimacy during istihadha, unlike Hayz, which is absolutely forbidden. And of course, a woman cannot, under any circumstances, have sexual intercourse while she is in her monthly period.
Yeah.
If she happens to have sexual intercourse, of course, she'll be liable for a kind of penalty. The amount of penalty is defined, of course, in the Book of Islamic Laws.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
With IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
Environmental campaigners will this week ask the High Court to rule that the British government's fossil fuel strategy is unlawful, in a case that could undermine the United Kingdom's claim to be leading the fight against climate change. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer's science editor Robin McKee. The piece is titled "Environmental Activists Challenge Unlawful UK Fossil Fuel Plan in High Court." Environmental campaigners will this week ask the High Court in London to rule that the government's fossil fuel strategy is unlawful, in a case that could undermine the United Kingdom's claim to be leading the fight against climate change. The campaigners will argue that the British government is effectively subsidising oil and gas production with billions of pounds in handouts, which conflicts with its legal duty to achieve zero net emissions by 2050. Pressure group Paid to Pollute says oil and gas companies receive billions of pounds in tax relief for new oil and gas exploration and billions more towards decommissioning costs between 2016 and 2020. The pressure group Paid to Pollute says this amounts to fossil fuel subsidies. Public money is supporting businesses that contribute to the climate crisis instead of solving it, said Karin van Sweden, one of three activists who will appear in court of law. Karin van Sweden added, "We have to challenge this deadly use of the public purse. If the Oil and Gas Authority won't use common sense, perhaps it will listen to the courts of law." The hearing comes as controversy mounts over the United Kingdom's oil and gas industry's attempts to gain approval for more than a dozen new schemes, even though scientists say new investment in oil and gas projects must stop if governments are to tackle the climate crisis seriously. Earlier this year, John Gummer, chairman of the Climate Change Committee, told members of the Scottish Parliament, MSPs in Holyrood. He said the justification for any new oil and gas exploration or oil and gas production has to be very, very strong indeed, and I cannot say I've so far seen any such evidence. Last week, one of the most controversial projects in Scotland, the Campbell oil field off the Shetland Islands, was abandoned by Shell, plunging the future of oil exploration in the area into doubt. Climate campaigners hailed this as the beginning of the end for the North Sea industry. Greenpeace said the damage from Campbell oil field would have been the equivalent of running 18 coal-fired power stations for a year. It's vital that the British government demonstrates leadership and shows how countries can transition away from oil and gas while reskilling workers and creating thousands of well-paid jobs in the process, said another claimant, Michaela Loach. All of this starts with the British government pulling the plug on the millions it gives to big polluters. This view was backed by Jeremy Cox, a former oil refinery worker and a third claimant in the action. Using public money to subsidize continued extraction and support a declining industry is the exact opposite of what this government should be doing. A British government spokesperson said the United Kingdom did not pay any fossil fuel subsidies. No other significant oil and gas producing nation has gone as far as the United Kingdom in supporting the sector's gradual transition to a low-carbon future, as demonstrated by our North Sea transition deal. While we're backing the United Kingdom's transition to green energy, there will be ongoing but diminishing need for oil and gas over the coming years, as recognized by the Independent Climate Change Committee.
Was feeling the danger of communists on the youth of Iraq. And since he was really knowledgeable in terms of the Islamic knowledge, on the other hand, because of learning English, he knew how to benefit from these two advantages and approach youth, try to nullify what the communist movement were doing and the bad impacts that they have upon the youth.
And regarding his works, one of the works that is done by himself is Tughus al-Shia al-Diniya, regarding the processions and gatherings held by Shia school of thought and Shia people during 4th up to the 7th after Hijra.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim, especially the Shiite philosophers, thinkers, and ulama during the history of Islam, all across the nation of Islam, with the presence of two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure, a Shiite figure, especially in the field of history and the study of codicology or the Islamic manuscripts. Is no one but Muhammad Reza Jafari Eshkevari, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Jafari. Muhaqqiq means researcher, so he's known by this title. Sheikh Ziyainia, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Muhaqqiq Jafari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Muhammad Reza Jafari Eshkevari, known as Muhaqqiq Jafari, was born in the 7th day of Shawwal of 1350, in the city of Najaf al-Ashraf in Iraq. He started studying Islamic studies in the city of Najaf, and during his young age, he continued his studying. He got a prominent scholar there, but unfortunately, due to the pressure of the Ba'ath regime in Iraq, he was forced to leave Iraq, and he was on exile somehow in Iran for 30 years.
That's right.
Of course, something that is very important regarding him is that during his young age, he moved to Indonesia for 6 months for preaching Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And this trip had a very deep impression on his future. And maybe that's why the book that is translated into English from Al-Kafi is the book that Muhaqqiq Jafari has put some, you know, notes on
notes
it.
Notes on that, that's right.
So he was a prominent scholar that learned from different maraji' and different teachers in Najaf, like late Sayyid Khoui Rahmatullah Alayh, late Sayyid Muhammad Rouhani Rahmatullah Alayh. And he got the permission of Ijtihad, the most important certificate that may be achieved in Hawza,
that's right,
by the His Eminence late Ayatollah Khoui Rahmatullah Alayh.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyani. And Sheikh Mahtavi, it's known that Muhaqqiq Jafari had a direct role in opposing the Marxist thoughts in Iraq. Talk a little bit about, the Marxist movements in Iraq and what did Muhaqqiq Jafari did in order to oppose them.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before we refer to the activities of late Allama Sheikh Muhammad Reza Jafari in regards to the communist movement before Ba'athi regime in the Iraq, I think this is good for our listeners to know that he was really benefiting from the scholarly family. Why? Because his father was the direct student of Mirzai Naini. Okay. And Sheikh Abul Hassan Isfahani. So, because of having such father, he was benefiting from his father knowledge at the beginning of his seminary school or lessons that he took from his father. Unfortunately, he lost his father when he was 12 years old, but we see that this is recorded in the history that from that time he started learning English. Just imagining that time, mm-hmm. Back then, for the alim who was participating in the traditional seminary school of Najaf on one side, and on the other side he's learning English.
That's right.
So it shows that how he was trying to keep himself up to date.
Yes.
That's why we see right now we reach to the question that you
That's
raised,
right.
that he was feeling the danger of communist on the youth
yes.
of Iraq. And since he was really knowledgeable in terms of the Islamic knowledge, so he was directly connected to Islamic resources. On the other hand, because of learning English and getting familiar with the other environment, the Western environment, he knew how to benefit from these two advantages and approach youth, try to nullify what the communist movement were doing and the impacts, bad impacts that they have upon the youth. That's why he is regarded as one of the knowledgeable scholars of Iraq against the communist activities
That's right.
before the Ba'ath regime.
That's right, along with Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Assad.
Yeah, definitely.
Sayyid Muhammad al-Nuri, these three great outstanding men. But I think it is, on that time, these Marxist communist ideas were spread in both Iran and Iraq on that time. This Eastern Bloc was really very much active. And as you said, the presence of such scholars like Muhaqqiq Jafari helped the believing, part of the community in order to nourish again and somehow answer some of the doubts and questions posed by this group.
I may add something
okay.
more. I think the other thing that he was enjoying mm-hmm. in terms of standing against the communist activities, his attendance in the University of Najaf.
Okay.
And this is very surprising that he was a great ustad or scholar of the Hausa.
Yes.
At the same time, he had been chosen as the best teacher or professor of the University of Najaf.
That's right.
For a long time,
okay.
several years, he had been chosen as the best professor. So it shows his strong interfere with the youth
That's right.
in the university.
Mm-hmm.
So he would understand what would be the understanding and the impact
yes.
of this movement upon the youth and how we can handle
That's right.
this actually dangerous idea or...
Okay.
Yeah.
And the opinions of the Marxist communist groups over there. That's all right. Let's get to some of the works of Muhaqqiq Jafari. Of course, a very big foundation by the name of Jafari is also available in Qom. This was not named because of Muhaqqiq Jafari. The name has been before, okay? But Muhaqqiq Jafari also helped this foundation very much by dedicating his books to them. They say that Muhaqqiq Jafari has a very big, great library of different manuscripts, so it was dedicated to this foundation and helped them very much in order to compile the books on Shiite Islam
and Islamic history. But Sheikh Ziyaniyan, let's talk a little bit about the most outstanding works that were compiled by he himself.
Because he was familiar with the English language, so he was supervising the translation of Al-Kafi and the translation of Nahjul Balagha in English.
That's right.
And this is very important. Translating the sources of Shia school of thought under the supervision of a mujtahid is very important. So this is something done under his supervision, and that's why we see that the translation of Nahjul Balagha that is done under his, authenticity is a good translation into English. Another important point regarding him is his relationship and friendship with Marhum Shahid al-Sadr. During the times that he was in Najaf and they were young students of Islamic seminary, they had a promise with each other to study the books regarding economic and different issues, sociology, that they are translated from other languages into Arabic. They were, having dialogue regarding these books with each other. And, these two figures, they came to, step by step, they came to this understanding that the community of Muslim Ummah is in need of big changes. And that's why, that generation, the generation of Shahid al-Sadr, the generation of Marhum Ja'fari and other scholars living on that time, they decided to, have a revolution in the Islamic thoughts of Muslim people at era, because people on those times, they were believing that either capitalism or communism is the prescription for, salvation in their life. Mm-hmm. That's why they were deciding to give different idea of Islam regarding Muslim life and Islamic life, so that Muslim people get familiar with the Islamic lifestyle and do not incline toward the beliefs of secularism or capitalism or communism.
Okay.
And regarding his works, one of the works that is done by himself, he has written this book, is Tughus al-Shia al-Diniya, that is written by him regarding the processions and gatherings held by Shia school of thought and Shia people during 4th up to the 7th after Hijrah. And he has chosen this era because Shia people during this era were minority in many, cities, and they were under the supervision of some governments that they were not good with Shia people.
That's right.
So he tries to get the stories regarding, for example, how Shias were holding the ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Ashura, or having, celebrations on the occasion of Eid al-Ghadir. Was that possible for them to gather easily? For example, he quotes that there were some people killed at the day of Ashura because they had procession. Or, for example, he quotes that in Najaf, a person went to the shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salatu wasalam and cursed upon those people who burnt the library of Shia.
Yes.
And he was captured and he was killed because of doing this action. And the benefit of this work is that when we study this book, we may come to this point that, nowadays that we are at ease and we are easily having our gatherings, we should, be thankful for this and be careful also not to, bother other Muslims and do not allow, misunderstandings regarding our school of thought.
That's right. These ceremonies and these sha'air, the rituals are really important. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, anything regarding Tughus al-Shia al-Diniya?
I think the period of time that he has chosen in order to record Shia ceremonies, and these two very important things, one is Ashura and the other is Qadir.
Yes.
Those things that Shia would do at that time, this is very important. Yes. Why, as my brother mentioned, during those time, although we had Buyid dynasty, which were related to Shia, but the dominant empire were Abbasi. So.
Yes.
Even at that time, still we had Sunnis in the power. So sometimes we might see some sort of objections and criticism upon Shia, saying that things that you are doing during the Ashura or Ghadir are kind of invention after the Safavid dynasty. This is a kind of famous criticism upon Shia nowadays. But I think if we consider this, or if we take this into consideration, we can acknowledge the importance of what he has done. Yes. By recording and compiling the type of ceremonies Shia would do during those times, which are really distant from us. Almost 10 centuries ago, Shia would mourn for Imam Hussein the same way today they are doing. Definitely. Almost 10 centuries ago, they would celebrate Qadir the same that they are doing here. Yes. or nowadays. So this is not something to be invented after the Safavid.
Yes.
So I think this choice, or picking from beginning of the 4th centuries, yes, till end of the 7th centuries, and recording all those ceremonies and type of mourning, mm-hmm, and celebrating of, yes, Shia will make us to really appreciate what, yes, he has done.
The authenticity of the rituals and the ceremonies during the history of Shia Islam, as you said, and how, as Sheikh Ziaynia said, they are the way that we are doing them today for our Shiite imams, for sure has roots in a very original source, which has been done by other ulama and the generation in the hardest and the harshest time of the history. And nowadays, the people are doing that at ease and for free, you know, in the 21st century. Really a very beautiful book on that part, especially I've heard that it is upon the Sunni resources too, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is based on the Sunni resources. So, I mean, these actions and the processions are also recorded in the Sunni references too.
Actually based on what they have recorded on what, yes, they have seen and observed.
Okay, observed. That's right. This is really beautiful. Okay, thank you very much. And Allama Muhammad Reza Jafari, known as Muhaqqiq Jafari, has said, dedicated his big library to a big foundation on books. It is called Jafari Foundation in the city of Qom, is still active. And this outstanding man passed away in the year 1431 in the city of Qom, but his body was taken in order to be buried in Wadi Salam Cemetery, the big Wadi Salam Cemetery in the holy city of Najaf. May Allah bless his soul and may he rest in peace. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziaynia and Sheikh Mahtabi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher.
You're most welcome.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another prominent Shia scholar, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.